Everybody, it's Jeff Dunham. How are you? Welcome to our second episode of the Jeff Dunham Podcast. I'm Jeff Dunham, and joining me right next to me here is Matt McNeil and Jeff Rothman. So, Matt, you and I have worked together for a long time, and Jeff, you and I have worked together for a long, long time, right?
Yep.
That's right.
And, Matt, you are kind of like the Swiss Army knife of everything that I do. I think that's a good description, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that when people ask me what I do for a living, I have a really hard time answering them. Like, I don't know. You know Jeff Dunham, I sort of do stuff with him.
But it's all things, it started out when you worked over at the other place, the place that you came from. You had worked there for how many years?
Well, a total of 17 years before I swapped over and started working exclusive with you.
Right. Wow. That's amazing.
That's a long time to be anywhere in Hollywood.
And that was like a long drive for you, wasn't it?
Oh my God. It was like 13 miles from my house and I'd sit in the car for 3 hours a day.
So I saved you.
you certainly saved the wear and tear on my car, so that's for sure. Right.
But now the pandemic has saved you even further because all three of us obviously have been working from home. And Jeff, yeah. You and I have worked together for longer than Matt and I have worked together, right?
Oh, yeah. I started touring with you, I think, in the 90s.
Wow.
Mid-90s.
Right, because you were my opening act for a good right. number of years. And when we started doing the arena things, you finally admitted to me that going on stage in front of these giant crowds wasn't your favorite thing, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Then why did you get into stand-up comedy?
I don't know. That was too much, man. I never thought I'd be playing an arena. You know, when I got to open for you, Jeff, it was an honor. But I mean, to hear people, you know, thousands of people walking in, I'm like, I was used to like, you know, maybe a couple hundred in a little club. And all of a sudden, I'm like, and they're not here to see me.
And that is the way this started with us, is in little clubs. We were at improvs and sometimes we'd be sold out. Sometimes I wouldn't.
I was just thrilled to go along on the ride, but then to walk into an arena one time, I remember, I think it was the first one you played, and I walked in with you and I said, do they play basketball in here? Like professional? I'm not kidding. I was like all of a sudden I started getting really nervous.
Yeah. You know, I should have known if I said one thing, we'd get off on a tangent here, but we are going to, I do have my interview with Gabriel Iglesias. No, I want to hear this, Jeff, but we do have my interview with Gabriel Iglesias and it went great. I did it a couple days ago and what a good guy, but wait, hold on, Jeff. So how long did we do these arenas before I finally figured out, or you finally admitted to me that this wasn't your favorite thing to do? How long was it?
It was just a few months, I think. And
it's when they started putting the score on the board. Rob Hand 2, Dunham 10.
Right. And I could just tell they were not here to see me. People were like, oh, we don't have to rush back to our seats. That guy's on.
Well, you were the opening act. That's the deal.
That's the deal. I get it. I got it.
We've done that for 15, 20 years in clubs, and it's like that's the thing.
But when it was the arena, I just thought, wow, there's so many more people not here to see me. I don't know how it affected me, but I remember not being able to sleep on the bus like you did. I was just worried about the next show the next day. I'm like, I can't believe I got to go in front of more people tomorrow. Why won't this just one end?
It's a nightmare.
So I'm glad you found other functions for me.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. You were just miserable the whole time.
I was just so relieved to get off.
And you were too nice to say anything about it.
After.
Yeah, and you were too nice. You were too nice to tell me.
Well, and, you know, it was fun, and when it was over for me, it was fun.
When it was over for me.
But hold on, now I can relax and have a good time.
All right, so that's so funny, and I feel like when you and I say that you write, but we write together because you come up with great stuff, and then I come in and noodle it a little bit and make it more, you know, just getting it more in exactly in the dummy's voices in my voice. So it's been a fun collaboration.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's why.
Oh, yeah, no, it was great. Or you'd give me the idea and say, you know, what do you think of this? It's like two comics just like coming up with ideas to make something better, you know?
Right.
So yeah, we had a blast doing that.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back to it one of these days. In the meantime, we have a podcast. Yeah. And let's talk about Fluffy a little bit. So I was interested. I was talking to a friend of mine who's slightly older than me, and he's in television. And I think Gabe has kind of the fame that is, it's huge, but there are these pockets of people that, well, like everybody, every celebrity's like that. There's there are the fans, and then there are people who are like, who? And you come across a guy, and when you hear that somebody say who, you go, how in the world do you not know how this person is? Because Gabe in the comedy world is, his success is almost unparalleled. As I tell him in the interview and point out, and he knows this, I think 98% of all comedians would give up a limb to be where he is now.
Yep.
He packs him in. He's another stadium guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And he points out during the interview that our arcs in the arena world kind of paralleled, because I had been out in Los Angeles for years doing the comedy clubs, and I don't want to give away the interview, but it's pretty interesting. It's great. And, I talked to him about the cancel culture and how is that affecting him. It's pretty fun. Wow. But Jeff, you had
I've worked with him before a little bit, and nicest guy. And then I volunteered for this thing called Stand Up With Comedy organization that actually teaches kids at school for an after school program how to do stand up. And one of the examples we always showed on a video screen would be Gabriel Iglesias, because his stuff was just so universal and family friendly at the same time. He was one of the only few comedians that kids all knew him. So all the kids knew him for sure. And he was great at storytelling. It wasn't necessarily the jokes we wanted to show the kids. We wanted to show them how you can tell a story and make it funny. And he was just a perfect example for the kids. And, you know, of course, adults love him too.
Right.
But he had that great appeal, and kids were all excited to see him.
Yeah. Right. And then Matt, how what was your interaction with him?
Well, the place that I worked before, you know, he would come in there occasionally and they would shoot specials with him. And so, you know, I was at the time doing a lot of graphics work, so 3D animation and title sequences. And so, you know, I spent some time with him in conference rooms, you know, noodling, you know, title ideas and things like that. And then ultimately, you know, animating them and them ending up in a special. So, you know, I'd spent some time with Gabe as well. And my experience was the same as Jeff, who's super, super nice guy and funny and, you know, all of those things.
Well, before we get to this, by the way, I just noticed, you know, this technology isn't perfect. And the way I'm doing this, I love this, doing it on the iPad. And next time you guys are going to have your own separate iPads, right?
Ooh,
we're
moving
one
on
here
up,
and one
Jeff.
Here. And for those of you just on the podcast only, this doesn't concern you. If you want to look at it on YouTube and see it, okay. But it's an unusual way of having guests on. But I've also noticed that I need to adjust a few settings, because Audrey's in the other room sending me text messages, and they keep popping up on the screen with you guys.
Oh, is that the dinging I hear?
Yeah. She's asking what he wants for lunch.
She's like, what are you doing in there? So I thought I had it worked out, because when I was interviewing Gabe, what popped up? So, Audrey sent me, it must be just Audrey, because she sent me my workouts on my calendar. And as I'm talking to Gabe, my workouts start appearing on top of the screen.
But that goes back to the fact that you're like, literally, you're one man band here. You're like doing all the switching and all the audio,
oh,
the
yeah.
graphics and the music.
Yeah, I won't let anybody in my house. Nobody's going to come set up this studio for me. Not even you, Matt. So I had to, you know, all three cameras and, you know, yeah, everything. So my fly in the ointment is that my text messages, calendar messages keep showing up on screen. I hope there's nothing embarrassing. Anyway, all right. Well, I would love to play everybody. Oh, and by the way, at the end of the interview with Gabe, which is really fun and enlightening and informative, At the end of all these podcasts, I plan on pulling out a character and doing a little bit where we just talk about the clip for 10 seconds and we show the clip and it's from one of my specials. And so that's the way we'll end each podcast. So we have somebody that, and also, Matt, we talked about this. We're going to try and somehow make it relate to the interview that I just did.
Right.
Yeah. And it was so funny. This one, we were talking yesterday, Jeff. I was sitting there and I rarely ever drink. I don't drink that much. And last night I just had a long, long day with a lot of manual labor. Wouldn't you call it that, Matt?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I was there for that.
Yeah. We had masks on, but a lot of hammers and saws and lifting.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah. And so after a day of manual labor, I always feel like having a beer. So I went in and I realized that we hadn't picked whatever clip it was going to be at the end of Gabe's interview. And I'm texting Matt and I'm going, man, I know I thought of it the other day, but I've had a whole beer.
Oh,
I had an entire beer, one.
Oh,
and so
no.
I couldn't remember.
Yeah, you're a lightweight, man.
I am, just a little bit. And so I couldn't remember. And then Matt said, is it this one? And I swear, Matt, we're brothers from a different mother or whatever it is. where you nailed it of all, you guessed exactly. I went, oh my gosh, it's exactly the one. It's perfect. So
wow.
That's the point.
He was wasted.
I had a beer. One beer.
I had four shots by the time he asked me. So.
Oh, well, it was a big can. All right. So why don't we get to talking to Mr. Gabriel Iglesias? How about that?
No, wait a minute. There's one thing I'd like to do, if you'll let me, Jeff, before you get to Gabe. I know it's March, but your Christmas present for me finally arrived, and I brought it over to your house yesterday. And if I'd love for you to open it live on the podcast and YouTube video.
I was almost hoping you'd forget about that. I promised you.
Oh, no.
I promise you I've been
doing this since Christmas. It's just taken a while, and I'll explain why it's taken a while when you get to it.
All right.
Mine's
well,
still coming.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much. Worked together for 18 years. Yeah, it's coming. I have to convert to Judaism to get a present from Jeff.
You're going to get 8 presents.
You'll get 8. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Get
8 of them coming. Why did I always think it was 7? Is this 7? 7 crazy nights? 8 crazy nights?
Yeah, 7.
8 crazy nights.
Yeah, 8 crazy nights. I don't know why. Oh, it has to do with history, right?
Okay. All right.
Don't ask.
But the song, what's his name?
Sandler.
Yeah, Adam Sandler. Is it 8 Crazy Nights?
It's 8.
Okay. Yeah.
He even made an animated movie with it, right?
All right. Why the number 7? Because 7 is a holy number. I think that's why it's stuck in my head. It's always 7 because 7 is 7 and 3 are like holy numbers. Never mind.
Actually, it's 6 and 3. 7 is just a lucky number.
Oh, no, I don't know. I forgot. Okay. All right. So I have this present. Okay. For those of you, again, listening just on the podcast, Matt, this makes no sense whatsoever.
Oops.
Well, but you can describe it. And then, you know, and I think that when you open it, wouldn't you say what it is? Because you're going to immediately recognize this. I have a feeling people are going to be with you. But can you do us a favor before you open it? Can you turn our iPad just a little bit so that Jeff Rothman and I could see the...
How about if I hold on. Let me choose this other camera here. All right, there. So now you got... Okay, so we want to turn the iPad. So you want to see...
Just a smidge. Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Now you can see what you're doing.
Now you can see what I'm doing. Okay. Yeah. You know, I've always wanted to say this. I've always wanted to say this on the camera. What's in the box? What's in the box? Yeah, what's in the box?
So here's a quick, before you open it, do you have any guesses what this might be?
Well, it feels like a frame.
Okay.
Yeah, and ooh, a nice, lovely bow. Did you actually wrap this, Matt?
Well, I did the paper, but Christy didn't have any, my wife didn't have any stick-on bows. So I had it sitting in the hallway, and when I came down yesterday morning, it had a bow on it. So.
All right.
She did it, or the bow fairies came.
All right.
But,
the bow fairies.
Do you have any guesses as to you're right about the frame? So
no, I have no freaking clue whatsoever.
You have no clue. Okay.
No.
So, yeah,
it feels like a framed picture.
Okay, it is, and I'll be honest with you, it's not a print. I commissioned a painter to paint this for you.
Oh my gosh! Oh, all right.
Wow.
Well, I can't get the bow off.
This is awesome radio.
It's one of those, it's one of those bows that's tied around and around. And oh my gosh. Okay, I got it. Right. And if I okay. This better be.
Wow, I'm curious.
Oh, it's great. It's something that you and I have talked about a lot.
Oh my gosh, this is fantastic. All right, yeah, all right. So how do I forget who it was? But okay, so everybody, if you want to see this, so this. Are you kidding me?
Okay. I commissioned a painter.
Okay, if you guys remember in the Jeff, do you know what this is?
I can't quite.
Okay, so this goes back. What? Okay, Matt, what chapel was it? Where was it?
It was in Spain.
In Spain.
And it was in 2012, I think.
In 2012.
Was it
a fresco or something on the wall of Christ that had been there for centuries, right? Like some monk.
For the 1500s, I think.
For the 1500s. And somebody said, I can, and it would started to chip. And the woman came in and said, I can fix that, right?
Right. Yes, in 2012, there was a lady named Cecilia Jimenez who went into her church and decided to restore this very, very sacred painting of Jesus. And she left. She was 81 years old.
Yep.
And this is what she came up with. And as a just sort of a, you know, Jeff and a couple of other friends of ours would occasionally reference this picture up.
Jim Ricker.
Yeah, and Jim Ricker, I had a legitimate artist recreate what is known as either Monkey Christ or Potato Jesus.
Oh my gosh! One of us here is going to hell, and it's not me.
But wait, this is the silver lining to all of this.
So
the silver lining to this is that the attendance at that church and the tourism at that church because of this lady. Within 6 months, 45,000 people came to this church to visit her version.
Let me hold it up for the other camera. This is going to go out of focus, but there it is. Matt, I'm telling you, that is spot on. Whoever did that, it looks. Because, and again, those of you who are listening, if you don't know the story, the version that the poor woman did it was absolutely horrible. It literally looks like a 6-year-old kid did it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But again, there was an upside, and she became very famous, and the church now has a tourism, not business, but people come to the church as a result of what she did.
Oh, that's pretty great.
This painting.
That's pretty great. So that was her contribution to the gospel, is that now more people have come to that church than ever would have.
Right. Exactly right. And I don't know if you notice, I picked this frame because it matches your new floors. So you can put it in your dining room.
It does. It matches our new walnut floors, which we had to replace because the aquarium broke. Right. Yep. Oh, that's...
Wow. I don't think you would have ever guessed that.
No, I...
But now that you've seen it, you know, you get it, right, Jeff?
Not in my wildest nightmares would I have ever guessed this. But Matt, I do. I question where in the world I'm going to hang this, but this is great.
I'm thinking maybe on that shelf behind you
or maybe
in the family room.
Oh my gosh. It'll be great. This, you know what? I love stuff like this because it starts conversations and people will go, what is that? And then I'll go, do you remember? And I'll have the whole story. This is perfect.
That's right.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Nice.
Maybe this should go next to the other piece of artwork that I have hanging in our entry that I don't want to talk about, but I'm really tempted to do a nerd alert about.
Oh, yeah. That would be good.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for the nerd alert. But if you want to see what this painting looks like, visit Jeff's YouTube because this video will be on there and you'll be able to
take Matt, I appreciate it. I must tell you that there was a lot of thought put into this. And
The one other thing that's kind of interesting about this is the artist did it, painted it, and then sent me a picture of it. And I said, it looks a little foreshortened. And the reference picture he was using was taken at an angle. So he had to literally repaint that potato Jesus on top of the old version of it. So it's actually a lot like the real church where there's a painting of Jesus over a painting of Jesus.
Wow, that's great. What was it, potato Jesus, and what's the other one?
The monkey Christ.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Terrible.
No. We're all going to hell.
Oh, yeah, well, no, I didn't do it as a joke against, you know,
okay, I'm going to stick
Jesus
with Hanukkah
or anything like that. Just because of the story, I think, is so fascinating and really, really funny and kind of an in-joke. So anyway, yeah.
All
Merry
right.
Christmas.
I appreciate it. It was absolutely worth the wait. Yeah. Oh, you know what we should do? Come on. We got to get Audrey in here. We have to. Okay. So I tell you what, when we come back after Gabe's interview, I'm going to have Audrey walk in before I do the bit with the dummy that I'm going to use. I'm going to have Audrey walk in and get her reaction to Matt, what you've given us.
To potato Christ. Potato Jesus. I'm sorry.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Oh, all right. So folks, all right. So I got to interview Gabe, and it went really well. And there's no more introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Fluffy. My guest today is a guy who I think almost any comic on the planet would give up a limb to be where he is and what he's where he's gotten. I mean, the accomplishments are amazing. If you don't know Gabriel Iglesias, it's movies, it's television, it's appearances, selling out arenas all over, not just this country, but all over the world. And he's on my very short list of comedian friends, and I'd like to bring him in right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my buddy Gabriel Iglesias. There we are. How are you, Gabe?
Hey, man. I'm doing good. I'm doing good.
Good.
It's, I got a little coffee in me because that's what's allowed at this point.
Oh, that's good. That's great. Yeah. So, you know, I know this is kind of a trite question at this point, but how has this last year affected you? Have you been having fun, not having fun? What?
Well, Jeff, you of all people know, man, what it's like to be on the grind, on the road week after week after week after week, and taking time for yourself is something that I haven't done in a long time. I mean, I don't take vacations. I don't take breaks because I have that mentality that, you know, if I stop, then, you know, it's going to go away. Someone else is going to take it. So I've been go for 22 years now. And this last year when the pandemic hit, I was basically forced to take a break, and I don't think I've ever gotten so much sleep. I used to average, about 3 to 4 hours a night, and right. I'd learn to sleep in places like planes, buses, cars, you know, at the venue, in a green room. I learned to sleep in random places, and so it took some getting used to, but now I average about 10 hours a night, and so when work starts up again, I don't know how I'm going to be, man. I made myself a lazy dude.
Ten hours a night. I don't even know what I don't know what that's like. But you know, that's one thing that to me that's interesting about you is and you talk about the work, and when somebody does something and they make it look easy, you don't know if they're working or not. And you know, I've watched your specials, and you're up there having so much fun, and I'm wondering, is this really work for you? I mean, do you wake up in the morning and say, okay, here's what we have to accomplish today. Here's a list of things. All these folks are working for me. Here's what I have to do. Or you just put it to the sales and let it, how does it work for you like that? Is it business?
The fun part is what's happening on stage. That, you know, that hour and a half to 2 hours every night, that's the fun part. The work is the getting up early, getting my butt to the airport, making sure all my stuff is packed, making sure I don't forget my passport, making sure, you know, getting to the venue, doing the sound check, doing the publicity. The press press is one of the hardest things for me. But just, you know, everything around it is the work, but the actual performance itself really isn't. Now, you know, when we do the specials, I don't know about you, man, but I'm very much like I got to be in the editing bay when the specials are going down. And, you know, every single thing that's happening on the screen, I make sure that all the edits are exactly the way that I want. So sometimes it takes a couple of weeks to get a special dialed in exactly the way I want, because I'm just so much of a, you know, like, oh, I just gotta make sure, you know. But that's the work. But the performance, I love. I do it for free.
Yeah,
but I'm glad that
I don't think people appreciate that. They don't realize that. I'll do the same thing. I'll walk off stage and go, well, that was a lot of work getting ready for that and writing everything. And you think, oh, you're done. No, all the work starts in post when you're going through that thing and making sure that every bit of it is seamless and funny. Right.
You got to have it tight, man. I remember too, man. I think you and I, as far as these specials go, we kind of have that same, we started cranking them out right around the same time where it's like, You had your first one with Comedy Central. Then I had one with Comedy Central. Then I think you had another one. Then I had another one. And then, you know, you jumped over here and then I jumped over there. So, you know,
yeah.
A little parallel going on right there.
Yeah. So, and that's the other. Okay, here's a crazy one. So you and I are apparently the most popular comedians in the Middle East. And I think that's still true. Now I understand me. I have a dead terrorist in my suitcase, Ahmed the dead terrorist. So they love that guy because they think he's one of them. But dude, what are the folks in the what is your hook with the folks in the Middle East? Why are you so huge in Abu Dhabi?
I think because I look. I resemble a lot of.
Come on, man. That's not it. Really?
Hey, well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with relatability. You know, how can you connect? Definitely, you know, we're entertaining, whether it's the voices, the characters, the stories. But, you know, somebody has to see a part of themselves in you in order to have a connection.
I think that's one of your appeals is that you are so seemingly approachable. You could be a complete a-hole. I don't know. But you're really.
Oh, I think you would have heard by now.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're right.
We run in small circles, man. Somebody would have told you. Tim Allen would have been like, "Yeah, man, look, you need to keep him off your set."
Yeah, you're right. Well, Leno already said that. No, I'm kidding. So, but you're so approachable, and one of the things that got me in I don't know if you said it in more than one special or not. I don't think so, but I think it was your second one where you said, okay, so. All you people, your fans, so whenever you see me in a restaurant or an airport, just coming up and say hi. I don't mind that. It's like I'm sitting there watching that going, are you effing crazy? But I think that's really, really commendable. And you mean that, don't you?
Opening the floodgates. Yes, I meant it until the pandemic hit. And then because like this last year, man, I've never been more afraid of people. Because
yeah.
I am every underlying condition that COVID goes after. Like all my friends that are working out and, you know, they eat organic food and stuff like that. COVID doesn't like you. It likes me. It likes people that eat GMOs, people that like to chill on the couch and sleep 10 hours. I'm a prime target. So I try to avoid going out.
Well, that's what somebody, you know, when I was talking about having you on. Oh, by the way, I got to tell you this. I got to get back to that. But what I asked the folks on my Facebook Live, who would you like to see me talk to? And I got to tell you, you were the number one guy that people requested. And I'll take that as a compliment. It's fantastic. But I also have to tell you that we also got a couple votes for Lee Majors, the $6 million man. So,
hey, it's me and Lee Majors.
You're in good company. Okay, so here's the question. So when I was talking to one of your people to line you up, they said, well, he's in a workout right now. And I'm like, whoa, a workout. Okay, so what can you tell us? What do you do to work out? Because you concentrate on your health now, don't you?
Yes. Well, that's the thing too, is that I've been, you know, working so long and just being on the road and living I shouldn't even say living the road life, but I mean, because I spent so much time out there, I didn't go to the doctor. I would eat just whatever was available. I wouldn't make, you know, conscious choices to better myself. Right. And so having nothing but time on my hands, I was able to lose almost 70 pounds. I'm in the gym 4 days a week. I got a personal trainer. I don't eat as bad as I used to. I see an endocrinologist now. I got my diabetes under control.
Wow, that's great.
Never felt so good, you know. So it's a life changer. I used to get off of planes and my knees would hurt, and it was getting bad. I think I stopped at the right time. I needed to get off the road and fix myself.
Well, that is a question though, because I know I had a one of your assets is your size. I mean, that's part of your act. That's your act. And so how do you balance that where you go, I got to get in health. I've lost this amount of weight. Is it just part of your, is it not going to be part of your routine? You just roll with it or what?
I think at this point, you know, I could be fluffy. I could lift weights. I could be buffy. I could grow a beard. I could be scruffy. Yeah, I've been around long enough to where people would be more concerned about me being around versus do I still have a gimmick?
Absolutely.
And after over, you know, being in this business for over 20 years, I might need a refresher. I might need to go in a different direction. But if you know, they say if it ain't broke, why fix it? So until things go a different way, I'm just gonna keep lifting weights. And I mean, don't get me wrong, you know you're a big dude when you can lose 70 pounds and you're still way overweight. So it's not like, oh man, he's so skinny now, I don't recognize him. No, I'm just less big.
Well, I commend you, because there's nothing more of a pain in the neck than trying to get in shape and lose weight. But so that's great. But let me go backwards a little bit before I talk about Mr. Iglesias and all the great things you're doing. I don't think I've found an interview where somebody says, "Who were you in high school?" And if these are trite questions, I apologize. I get asked that all the time. How'd you get your start and all that? But for the folks who aren't initiated into the fluffy world, who were you in high school? I mean, what kind of guy? What was going on with you then?
Believe it or not, I was actually very quiet. I'm not over the top. I'm not the person that needs to get all the attention at the table. I really love to just sit back and listen. And when I'm given the opportunity to, you know, have the floor, that's when I make it rain. I took a course in high school, a couple courses. One was exploratory teaching, and another one was speech and debate. And both allowed me to get up in front of a classroom and just talk. And I got really comfortable speaking in front of people. I think that's one of the hardest things to do in life, is to be able to get in front of people. And so once you can get over that, then you can start applying other things, you know, what your message is, humor, whatever it is you're going to do. If you, you know, a talent, you sing, whatever your skill set is. So I think that helped me out a lot in school. But me, I was very much, like I said, just I was a listener, and I was pretty quiet. I only had a couple of friends, and the cool part is I still have those same friends from high school.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really good. Yeah, I was one of those lucky kids who grew up in the same house my entire life. And but I was thinking about this, because talking to you about that, we all grew up together, but I only kept up with one guy, and he would end up being my college roommate, and that was Glenn. But yeah, so you weren't the class clown.
No, not at all. Not at all. And you've been around a lot of comics, Jeff. You know how it is. Sometimes you're around someone that's chill, easy to talk to. You can talk about regular things. And then there's other comics that you hang out with, and they're like, dude, can you turn it off? Can you take a breath? Oh, yeah. Is everything a joke?
Yeah, they're constantly on, and you feel and there's also some sort of like a wall that you can't get through.
It's a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't get to them. Okay, so the high school, that was you, and then again another trite question. So how did the comedy thing eventually happen?
I wanted to be a comic since I was 10 years old. I didn't know it was comedy just yet. There was a couple of influences for me. There was a guy, an impressionist named Rich Little. I don't know if you remember Rich Little from back in the day.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, not necessarily a comedian, but one of the greatest, like, you could close your eyes and see who he was mimicking. You know, he had the best Carson, Reagan, all the people of that time. And I was like, wow, I really like how he does the voices and the characters. And then I saw Eddie Murphy, and I'm like, whoa, this is a whole different, like, he's not spot on with the impressions, but I love his persona and the characters and just the storytelling and how awesome it is. And that, for me, is what sparked wanting to be a comic. And so I did a school talent show, and I didn't have any jokes, really, but I was really good at doing voices, and that's what I did. And I didn't know that people would like it until I saw it firsthand. And, you know, you go through puberty, and so, of course, 10, 11, 12, right around that time, voice started changing, and I didn't get back into it until high school.
Yeah, we were watching a while back, and the one thing that freaked my wife out was your female voice. She was just amazed at your female voice. So I was impressed. It is the sound effects, the voices. Again, people that don't know you and haven't watched your act have no earthly idea. And there's a lot of great stuff there. And that's coming from me. And by the way, I see Ahmed back there in the back. So thanks for doing that. And I'm not stupid. I'm not stupid. I know that it was not there 20 minutes ago before we started this. It's like going to a relative's house and they put all your pictures up. Yeah, sure. That's never there. Hey, one thing, a little side note here, man. We both got big with the Funko Pops, right?
Yeah. Yes.
How many Funko Pops have you signed in your lifetime?
If I could hold myself out a little bit.
There it is. That's great.
Fluffyguy.com. Yeah.
Okay. So how many have you signed? You know?
I, man, probably 20,000.
Okay, you got it. So you have two out now, right?
Yes, and we're working on a third one, and we also have a keychain.
Wow. All right. Well, so my second one's coming out soon, but I signed 10,000 of the first one. But, dude, this killed me. You're killing me. You signed a few of them in gold and called them the limited edition.
The variant. I mean, you know, basically what happened is that I had a few that they just either the paint wasn't right on them. You know, I look at all the figures and you always want to make sure that people get the best quality. And so I noticed that some of them just they were missing little just paint.
Right.
And so I figured, I got a little collection of the ones that didn't have the best paint on them. And I got some Krylon from Home Depot and basically made my own little ghetto version of the Chase, because they do have Chase figures that come in gold and blue and chrome.
Yeah.
But I made it very clear to the people, this is ghetto. I did it myself.
Yeah.
The paint might not even match right. There might be run marks. And I autographed 40 of them, and people went nuts. Yeah. I'm like, you do know that I did this. Funko didn't do it. Funko made the original one, and of course, all I did was just add paint to it.
Yeah.
And it was insane. People... The I call them Mother Funkos, because they're just crazy for the Funkos, man. They're just there's the fans that you have, that you and I have. We have our fans, and then there's the Funko fans, and that's a whole different breed.
Yeah.
And you have to understand exactly how they think, because I've been yelled at for so many different things. Like I didn't know that the box was just as important as the figure itself.
Oh man, how many did you get returned? People all pissed off because there was a little tiny fold in one of the corners, right?
Yes, I mean the detail on the corners. They look at everything. Like if the corners bent even a little bit, like see right there, there's a dent in the top that you can see right there.
Yeah,
that would somebody would get mad over that, and you'd look at it and go, "There's nothing wrong with the box. What do you? It's just a box." And no, it's the whole thing. That's why when we mail the stuff out, it's like quadruple protected. There's a box inside of a box with bubble wrap.
Yeah.
They love everything about the figure, the packaging.
Sure.
So, I got a couple complaints. The first one, definitely, it was a learning experience. People getting upset over a lot of different things. And I'm like, are you a fan of me or a fan of the figure? And I had people buying the figure that didn't even know who I was, but because that was the new... it was a number one.
Yeah.
It was, you know, a number on it.
Of the comedians.
And so when people saw the number, they're like, oh, we want to get the number one.
Yeah.
And I had no idea. And so it was very much a learning. Now we know.
Right.
So now we take all the precautions. But yeah, Funko is no joke.
I do wonder what percentage of the people that purchased them from us, this is the comedian series, I wonder what percentage of them are our fans versus just the Funko fans. You don't know.
It's definitely a mixture. It's definitely a mixture, because I've seen both of our figures on eBay and other reseller sites and stuff. And yeah, you can tell they're just in it to flip it.
All right. So, you know, for a number of years, people have been saying to me, you and Fluffy should do a show together. But what I want to go into here on this is this crazy culture that we're in right now. Is it helping or harming your act? And your ability to do comedy,
you know, when I'm feeling it, I think it's a little much. It is a little much, because I pride myself on doing a show that everyone can enjoy. Everyone knows that when I go out there, I'm not trying to get political. I'm not trying to get religious. I'm not trying to be divisive. I'm not trying to make people feel bad. It's a feel good show. You know, there's some people that want to go out there and they got their, you know, their angle. And my angle is I just want everybody to leave happy. And if I'm offending you, it's not intentional, but nowadays the bar keeps getting moved and it's hard to keep up, and you never know what's safe and what isn't. And that really sucks, because now when I'm performing, I'm always thinking, is this okay to say? Is this okay to say? Versus let me just be creative and throw stuff out there.
We can't do that anymore.
You gotta censor yourself before you even try material that's not even going to be on a special yet, you know. And so how do you figure out what's going to work and what isn't, and trying to stay on top of what's right and what's not right, what's politically correct and what isn't, and are you being mindful and woke? So it is hard.
You have a fear of being canceled.
Being canceled, yeah, you know, and everybody has their different ways of canceling, whether it's getting you kicked off a TV show or getting you your social media shut down or don't come to this town no more. I don't get it. Yet, you know, some comics can say what they want and it's not a problem, and everybody continues to support them, and others make one bad joke or bad tweet and bye.
So where do you think this is all going to head then?
I'd like to think that at some point people are just going to get fed up with it and, you know, just say, look, just enough is enough. If we're going to have this, let's have it. If we're going to be comics and entertainers, let us do what we do. Clearly, you know, you can be mindful as just basic common courtesies. You know, I'll respect you. You respect me. But, you know, if you're a comic who intentionally goes out there and tries to start stuff, then OK, then there might be a problem. But again, if I'm feeling it, it's rough, because I did a couple college gigs and I remember telling a couple stories that I'm like, really, that's offensive? How? And things had to get explained to me. And I'm like, well, you went way out there to explain that. And it's only a couple people that felt the same way you did. So help me understand why your view is better better than my view. So,
well, there used to be the sanctity of the live show, and there was a safety there in that club or in that theater or even that arena that you could say, you could be a comedian, you could be yourself. And my true belief is that as comics, you know what the line is for your audience, right? And, you know, as a comic, you go to that line and step over it a little bit. And that's what usually gets the biggest laughs. But you do that today and you're done.
Yeah. And the problem that we have now that we didn't have back then, which is a double-edged sword, is the phone.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Nothing gets us seriously, without social media, YouTube and everything else, we couldn't have the careers that we have now. I mean, I know you're already an established, very, you know, famous comedian before social media hit. But once YouTube kicked off, man, that's when we were able to start touring the planet,
right,
and have incredible numbers that we do. But at the same time, man, somebody starts recording you when you're just starting to plant the seed of how can this be funny, without you getting a chance to really work it out, work those kinks out, take the bad stuff out so that you can only give people what's good.
Oh, I wouldn't want to be a stand-up today starting. I don't know how these guys are, these men and women, I don't know how these folks are doing it. I mean, with that, everything that's great is, you're right, it's on a phone and it either ends up out there or it's out there too early and you're done.
You know, I keep getting people asking me, what's some good advice for starting off being a comedian? I said, pick a different year.
Wow, that's really great. Yeah, because you hear about a lot of the guys that won't do colleges anymore, just won't do them. And I don't know where it's all heading. It's just kind of frightening to me. And anyway, so Mr. Iglesias is doing well. You have another season coming up on Netflix?
You know, Netflix is Netflix. That's how I'll put it. You know, you don't know till you know. It's not like a traditional network where every time an episode airs, you get the numbers the next day, and here's what the what do they call it, the Nielsen ratings and this and that, and
right,
you know, here's how we're going. You know, they could say, oh, we're gonna give you 22 episodes, and then halfway through they're like, yeah, no, it's not gonna work. Whereas Netflix, man, they got their wheel of algorithms and what's trending and what's not trending. And
you know, I found out their secret. It's actually a Ouija board.
Nice.
So, okay. So that in mind, you got the TV show, you've had the movie, you've done voiceovers. It is unbelievable, the list of voiceovers that you've done. It is so incredible and so great. So my question is, what gets you up in the morning? What, whatever project is going to happen, what is that project that day that you're the most excited about? Is it the stand-up? Is it a movie? Is it a TV show? What is it? Or is it a hobby? Something nothing to do with what we're talking about.
You know, my favorite thing to do, of course, is stand-up. But being that's not an option for me right now, and there are some states where you can go and do clubs and do half houses and stuff like that, it's still not worth it for me to risk my health until I'm in a place where, you know, I'm fully vaccinated, and that the numbers go down. So I'm going to be staying home until then. But voiceover work is something I can do from home. I got a studio in the back, and I've managed to crank out about 6 movies in that studio, which is pretty awesome.
Oh, that's great. You know what? I'm going to fire my agent. you've had 6 movies during COVID?
Well, you know, being able to do voiceover work, ADR and stuff like that. Yeah, I got a studio in the back. It's legit. And sometimes they send me their own equipment, and sometimes I use my own.
Okay, so you have a studio in the back, but you put me on the iPhone. Thanks, dude. Thanks a lot. I got this high quality studio I built in my office, and I get the freaking iPhone. Thanks a lot. Look, I even have a nice microphone here. Thanks a lot. So, is there anybody that I don't think you're this kind of guy, but this fame, this you did not expect this. Is that correct? Did you ever in your wildest dreams, as a 10-year-old kid wanting to be a stand-up, think that it would go this far, or even dare to dream?
I don't think that when I started doing stand-up in 1997 that any of this was possible. You know, it's not something that you can imagine even doing. These weren't possibilities yet. If anything, my only goal back then was I just want to quit my day job and I just want to be a comedian. So whatever that meant, you know, it's like I wasn't trying to get a TV show. You know, a lot of comics in the beginning, they're like, oh, I want to get my own sitcom. I want an HBO special. That was the holy grail back then. You want to get your own HBO special or you want to be on Carson. Not The Tonight Show, but with Carson. It was Carson. Carson was the guy that freaking thumbs up, thumbs down. You know, you get a thumbs up, you can go work in Vegas for a couple months and you're gold. But back then, I just wanted to quit my day job. I just wanted to go out, make people laugh,
and get a free meal.
I had a really good day job. I was working for a company called LA Cellular. I was selling cell phones when they first kicked off. So I was selling that Motorola PC550 flip phone, the brick phone. You know, nowadays it's like you got a phone, you drop it, and that's a $200 screen that you got to repair.
Right.
But back then, man, those phones were indestructible. Like, you know, and the amount of you know, energy coming off, like you could feel the cancer growing in your head. The radiation was so strong, it was like putting your head in a microwave.
Oh, I don't know if it's fake or not, but they were like a brick, literally like that big. And I don't know if this is true or not, but there was apparently a guy who got a tumor the shape of that cell phone on the side of his head.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You could feel it though. You'd feel it. It was like getting a lot of x-rays in your face.
So you were selling those, and then what?
I was selling those phones, man, and I was making a killing. You got to figure, 1997, I was 20 years old. No, wait, 1997. How old was I in 97? I was about 20 years old. I was clearing about $5,000 a month. Now, $5,000 is a lot of money now, but to be doing that back then with commissions, man, I didn't think it could get better. I had full coverage medical, dental. My mom was like, Nico, you made it. You made it, Nico. I go, what do you mean? I go, well, you have insurance. We had never had insurance. We had Vicks and good luck. That's what we had growing up.
Oh, man.
So I had medical.
That's funny. Yeah.
And there's to leave something that secure. My mom was like, are you crazy? You're going to leave this. You're making so much money. You're doing really well for yourself at such a young age, and you're going to give that up to chase this passion. And nobody was on board with it. Nobody wanted me to pursue this. And I did, fortunately. And I struggled for about 3 years where, you know, I wasn't making that kind of money that I was making at the cell phone company.
And this was in San Diego, or you moved up to L.A. by then?
I was already living in Long Beach at the time.
Right.
And I knew that I needed to be living in the L.A. area in order for this comedy thing to work. Geographically, I just always, all the TV shows were in Hollywood. Everything was in Hollywood. Everything was in L.A. I didn't hear of San Diego being the pop-off spot for entertainment. It was L.A. And so I knew I needed to be here. And so when I turned 18, my mom, you know, they say, oh, when you turn 18, you can move out of the house. I didn't move out of the house. My mom left me in the house, and she went to San Diego, and she said, you can keep paying the rent here. And I couldn't. And
wow.
So that's when I wound up. That's when I wound up living with my brother for a few months, and then my sister let me ride her couch for about a year until I was able to start chipping in.
And you started chipping in by, so where'd it go? You started playing clubs? Did you get an agent? How did that work around here?
The first year, I was very, very lucky that I was able to start getting work right away. My first road gig was a little less than 3 months before the first time I hit the stage. My start date was April 10th, 1997, and my first on-the-road gig was this poster back here. This poster right here, it's July 9th, 1997. So, yeah, just a few months later, I was already on the road doing stand-up. And it was one of those things where no social media back then. You had to actually talk to people. You're like, hey, man, do you know a place that might, you know, need an MC, somebody to host a show? And, you know, you do one gig, you meet people there, then you wind up, it keeps branching out and branching out. And eventually, you know, you're just picking up that phone. Hey, man, do you need a guy? Do you need a guy? And that, you know, I started getting a lot of work as an MC. And before I knew it, I was featuring for people. And then that first year, I was on a show on Comedy Central called Make Me Laugh. And the goal is you go out there in front of a person, you get 30 seconds to sure. make them laugh. And it went over well. I got to tape it like three times. And so three television show checks, man, my mind was blown. I'm like, I'd never seen money like that. And then I was on a show called Funny is Funny. And before I knew it, I got offered the Comedy Central half hour special in New York.
So this is interesting to me because this to me is not the same. Everybody has a different story, but most stories for comics are similar. It's like time after time at the Improv or whatever club you want, you get up on stage and you get your 15 minutes and that goes over and over and over. But you sound like you started and it was like almost immediately you're on television. You didn't do 10 years of doing a club. It's like your appeal was there already for you being a guy, and whatever you were saying on stage was people wanted to hear more of it, and it translated to television. Is that about right?
Yeah, I couldn't get into the clubs. All of my gigs were at venues that were not comedy clubs unless I went on the road. I got a TV credit before I got to perform at an LA club.
What?
You know, I my first actual comedy club that I got to perform in was the Comic Strip in El Paso, Texas. Even though I'm from LA, I had to go to Texas to get on a comedy club stage. But every night I was performing at you know, there was a bunch of one-nighters in town, regular shows that comics would put on. And so I'd be performing at a bar in front of 20 people, 30 people, sometimes 50 people, depending on the night of the week. Everybody had a room. And so I just jump around town doing my rounds. And sometimes I get paid, sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I was performing for a soda and maybe a burger if I was lucky.
I have never heard this story about anybody else before. No, nobody starts like that. That's pretty amazing and pretty great. And so you were, but by the time you got to the Improv chain and the bigger chains, you were already an established guy on TV and had your trajectory was already getting ready to hit the stratosphere, right?
Yes. And I think it's one of those, for, you know, any comics now working, it's like a lot of times you think that Hollywood's going to make you, if Hollywood's not knocking on the door, you got to create your own doors. If you need to leave town in order to get work, then that's what you got to do. You got to go where the work's at or create your own work. Like I said, performing at clubs in LA, I didn't get a chance to do the Laugh Factory until they had a Latino night. That's when I finally got a chance to touch that stage. Or I'd sneak in on Chocolate Sunday or something. You know, there was always a messed up theme night. I couldn't just be there on, hey, it's just funny night. No, I had to go there on a night that was very specific. And so I knew what I was working with. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to get the support I need here. I need to create my own opportunity. So, you know, back then, no social media. So what did we have to do? We had to go out and make flyers. I was really good at working my computer. And so I knew how to make flyers. And so I'd pass out flyers. I'd talk to people. I'd hang out after shows. I'd take pictures. I'd tell people, hey, if you like what I'm doing, you know, I'm going to be doing some more shows over here. Here's some free tickets. Bring some friends. We're going to do a show. If you want to hire a comic. I did so many garage gigs and pool parties and quinceañeras and weddings. There's videos still online of me performing at weddings. And I didn't even have the right clothing to perform. I mean, I was just a basic T-shirt and some pants and a hat on backwards. And I was doing whatever I could do. I took every gig. And the crazy part is that I documented on paper just how many shows I was doing. And I was looking at it the other day, and my first year, I had 180 sets. Second year, I had over 250. Third year, over 300. And it's like I was averaging almost as many days out of the year performing.
Yeah, this is amazing because you look at you on stage and you don't get that there's this big business acumen to you. From what I said at the beginning, you make it look easy because it's fun for you. It looks fun for you. There's so many guys that you hear about that kind of stumbled upwards to success. You obviously have a real drive and a want to succeed and to get better, bigger and better. So was there ever a moment where you said, this is it? Is there an it moment for you in the career yet so far?
I think there's a lot of steps. You know, there wasn't one actual moment, but there was a lot of little moments that led to, you know, us having this conversation right here. You know, whether it was when I decided to quit my day job, when I finally got a chance to work in Los Angeles, when I got on the Tonight Show, when I got my first 1 hour special, when Comedy Central said, hey, we're going to give you another one and we're going to do this. You know, that when I signed the deal with Netflix, when the sitcom happened. The big one for me, where I actually said it on stage, where I says, you know what, I've arrived. And I never wanted to say, oh, I had achieved a certain level of success, because I think I feel that once you say it out loud, you stop growing and you stop working towards growing bigger and better.
Sure.
But I couldn't ignore it. I'm performing at Madison Square Garden a couple years ago.
Right.
And I'm telling them the same story. And I says, you know, guys, I go, every time a reporter would ask me, when did you know you made it? I go, I would never say it for that same reason, that you never, you know, you don't want to stop growing and this and that. I go, but let me tell you, it's a little hard when you're performing inside of the most iconic venue in the world. I said, so the next time a reporter asked me, when did you know you made it? I said, I'm going to have a date. And then I said the date of that performance, which was April 15th, 2015. Ah, shoot. Yeah. I forget the year, but I think we're 2021 now. But I said the date and I said New York City, and the whole crowd went crazy and I started crying because I knew, I'm like, wow, this was one of those moments where it's like, I'll never forget this night. And if I never perform at Madison Square Garden again, it doesn't matter because I made it here. I got it.
That's perfect. Well, you know, I told you this when I first asked you to do this, that one of the things that we don't hear from when we talk to people, to successful people, we always talk about their successes and how what they've done that's so great and their accomplishments, but rarely do you get to hear what I call are the learning moments. And those are those moments that you either had doubt or you failed or you screwed up or life hit you in the upside the head and you didn't know if you could keep going. So I'd like to ask you that question of, first of all, were there any moments of doubt where you said, I don't know if this is going to happen? I'd like to start with that one. So were there any times when you thought, you know what, I maybe better find something like the phone gig again? Would any of that ever happen? Along this way?
I'd be lying if I said no. Most comics are very insecure people, and I'm very insecure. So I'm always – and I think that's also what keeps me sharp. That's what keeps me wanting to continue to grow and make sure, like, don't take your foot off that pedal, man. But, yeah, man, there's been several times when I thought, like, oh, like April 10th, 1997 is the official start date. April 10th of 2007, of course, my 10-year anniversary – I had one of the worst bombs of my life, and it was at the Laugh Factory.
This is funny to me because when you already have an audience and you're sold for a while, you're good on stage. I don't know what Seinfeld said in the movie. You got like what, 2 minutes or 3 minutes? So it's kind of hard to screw up. So I can't wait to hear this.
this one was pretty epic, and it falls along those lines of, like, you know, what can you say, what can't you say, and know your audience. So Carol Leifer, you know, comedian Carol Leifer?
Sure.
Okay. She has an organization that's all about dogs and cats and you know, raising money for them, you know, get them spayed, neutered, adopted, just, you know, an animal thing, you know, she hits me up and she's like, hey, listen, we're having a fundraiser for my organization. I know, you know, you have pets. Would you like to donate your time and help out the cause? I'm like, no problem. I'd be happy to do it. It was with Tom Papa, Jay Leno, and myself. The three of us and Carol Leifer was hosting. And so we go there, and there's a whole red carpet and everything. The press is there. It's a pretty big event. You know, she's raising money for this. And Leno gets to go first because at the time he's taping The Tonight Show. And so he goes up on stage, and he does about 15 minutes. And he starts doing a bit about how he hates his wife's cats. Well, as soon as he starts doing that, you could feel the crowd. Like, these are animal lovers, right? They're not traditional. They're not traditional comedy club goers. These are people that are there for the cause. And so as soon as he starts talking about how much he dislikes his wife's cats, you could feel the room. And he keeps going in and going in and going in. And they're laughing because it's Leno, but it's that uncomfortable, like, hey, man, I got a cat, you know? And so it's getting to an ugly place, and right at the end, Leno looks at the crowd and says, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to donate $10,000 to your cause so you guys can continue to save these animals and get them the help that they need. And as soon as he said that, the crowd erupted. They're like, oh, my God, because Kara had one of those, like, a thermometer that showed the goal, like, you know, right. We want to fill this thing up. And right. So Leno, right out the gate, like, filled it, okay?
Right.
He already raised the money himself. And so the crowd's on their feet, standing O. They're going crazy. He walks off stage.
That's
and
cheating.
I'm like, what the hell was that? Right? That's so basically cheating. And so Tom Papa goes up on stage.
Right.
And Tom Papa's opening line is, hey, keep it going for Jay Leno paying $10,000 to shit on cats.
Oh, no.
And the crowd went nuts. And after that, he had him.
Oh, no.
He had him, and he killed it. And so I'm closing the show, and I go up there, and I'm just doing my regular set. And then I says, you know what? These are animal lovers. I go, let me tell some animal stories, you know, about my dogs.
Right.
And so I started telling a story about my dog, Bruno, who had a habit of peeing on me to let people know that I belong to him. Like, whenever guests would come over the house, he would walk over to me and he would mark me. He would mark me because he felt threatened by whoever walked in the house. It was the weirdest thing. He was very, very old school. Uh-huh. And so I'm telling the story, and the crowd is laughing. And then I says, yeah. So one night I'm laying in bed, and I says, and he peed on my back as I was sleeping. And so I wake up, and he's nailing my back. And I says, so I kicked him off the bed. And when I said I kicked him off the bed, I kind of said, so I kicked him off the bed, kind of like there was some action and motion. So I kicked him off the bed.
Right.
And I heard in the back of the room, a lady yells out, he kicks dogs.
Oh, please.
And when she said that, I thought she was messing with me. And I say, yeah, I'm a dog kicker. And then I did the whole, like, I kicked something, and I made the sound. Well, let me tell you, that did not go over well. They started chanting dog kicker.
Oh, no.
And they started getting the room. I mean, what they did to Leno was nothing. When I said, yeah, I'm a dog kicker, and I did the sound and the burr. Oh, dude, it was horrible. They started booing, chanting dog kicker, and here's where I thought I was going to lose it. I'm looking out in the crowd, and remember, this was a red carpet event
sure. In
L.A., and so there's all this media sitting in the front rows, and I recognize people from the news. I could see Jane Velez Mitchell sitting in the right dead center, and she's giving me this look like, ooh, really? Like, I can't wait. Jeff, let me tell you, it got so bad. Carol Leifer had to come up and take me off the stage like a referee at the end of a fight when someone's getting the hell beat out of them.
Sure.
And they kind of put their arm around you and they're like, it's over.
Oh,
she's
no.
Like, go, 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 go. So I run off the stage and it's the Laugh Factory. So you're weaving in and out of people and I'm getting the comments as I'm moving. I get to the back and I just bolt out the door.
Oh, man.
I bolt out the door and, you know, at the club, you get to valet. That's one of the few clubs where you can actually valet your car.
Right.
I get out there, and when I walked in, my car was in front. And when I walked out, they had to get the car. So now I have to wait, and people are walking outside to tell me what they think about me being a dog kicker.
Oh, man.
And so they're talking smack to me from the door, and then valet's like, what's going on? You know, and I'm like, oh, man, they're mad at me because of a dog kicking reference. And so now he's getting mad. He's like, ¿te gusta patear los perros, cabrón? ¿Te gusta? And so now He gives me my keys and he's like, your car's over there. I'm like, I thought you were going to bring it. And he's like, he sends me to go get my own car. I get in my car and I'm crying.
Oh, no.
Because I'm like, oh my God, people think I abuse animals and this just happened in front of LA media.
Oh,
I thought my career was over that night.
Wow.
You know, and let me tell you something. I'm one of those types that, you know, it was 10 years to the day. It was my 10 year anniversary. And it's like, really full circle. And so I didn't get on stage for 2 more weeks after that. I was so petrified. I was just like, oh my God, I'm done. Word's going to get out. And so at that moment I was like, you know what? I think I had a good run.
Wow.
I think I had a good run.
Wow. And what year was that again? That was year.
It was 2007.
Okay.
April 10th, 2007. I'll tell you the date exactly. April
but 10th, it was the year before that, which is also, if you don't mind talking about just for a second, is when you got kicked off Last Comic Standing, right?
You see a pattern, huh?
No, I was just.
I made history being the first Mexican ever deported off NBC.
Thank you. Good night, everyone. So just quickly tell me about that, because what I read, I was like, are you kidding me? I have a Last Comic Standing story that I'm not going to tell it now, but it's an ugly one. So, but what happened? Did it really involve a cell phone? What happened?
Man, look, I was in a new relationship, and again, the insecurities were there.
Another dog kicker?
But coming, yeah, the dog kicker.
Another one.
Coming into this show, I was already a working comic, mm-hmm. and so they were making the angle of the show that I'm the ringer, I'm the guy that's, you know, everybody's headhunting for me because I'm the outsider who's already a working comic coming into this show.
Right.
I needed to stay in touch with the outside world. Cell phones were not permitted, but I'm like, no, I got to check and make sure she ain't out freaking, you know.
Sure, of course. Yeah, I get it.
I got to make sure she ain't not hooking up with George Lopez or something. You know what I mean? I got to keep tabs.
All right. And
so I snuck in. Mm-hmm. I snuck in not just a cell phone. I snuck in a number of cell phones in my luggage. I used the lining of my luggage and I taped cell phones into it. And a big wad of cash just in case I needed to pay somebody off at the hotel.
Wait, what?
And that's exactly what I wound up doing.
Pay somebody off at the hotel for what?
Well, here's the thing with Last Comic Standing, the year that I did it, is that all the comics were put into isolation. And basically, they wanted you to be at a secured location. They didn't want you to have contact with the outside world because they were afraid you were going to leak what was happening on the show.
They were
afraid that you were going to get material from the outside world to help you win the show.
I see.
You know, I already had a set, so it wasn't like I needed material, but I did want to stay in touch with my girl.
I had forgotten that. So everybody was completely isolated for however long you were on the show.
Yes.
Okay, great. It's like the show.
So the hotel.
Yep.
The hotel was actually in my hometown. It was at the Queen Mary. And so once I was on the boat, you know, they couldn't keep tabs on everybody at all times. And so, you know, there was a camera crew going around cabin to cabin, checking on people. And then throughout the day, you'd bump into people and stuff. So we had our areas where we were allowed to be, but we couldn't have the phones. We could call, like if we wanted to make a phone, it was like prison. You know, there's a specific time you can pick up the phone and you can make a phone call and yes and no. And they listen in. They would listen in on the calls.
Right.
And
you were a big shot by now, still.
Like I said, I went in there with a wad of cash. So I was what I was doing is I was paying off the staff that works there to let me get off the boat. I had a car in the parking lot. I would take off and I would go to restaurants. I go to my house and check my mail. I go visit my girl and I come back. Oh, all this was going on and nobody knew. But I had I greased the wheels with a couple people to kind of cover for me while I was making my rounds.
I finally found the crack in Gabe. All right, fine. Just
cheater. Yeah, yeah. And so. So the camera crews would come by to my room and they're kind of, you know, there'd be questions like, where did that Jack in the Box rapper come from? Where did this come from? He's got, you know, I'd have stuff from the outside. I'm telling you, it was like prison. So what wound up happening one day is that I had a BlackBerry. This is before iPhones. Okay. I had a BlackBerry cell phone and I was texting and I had a pillow on my lap. And so I must've looked like I was talking to my balls or something. I was down here and I'm texting and I look up and the camera's right in my face.
Oh, no.
I'm like, oh, my God. And they're like, what do you got there, Gabe? And I'm like, nothing. And they grabbed the pillow and there was the phone. And that's when the scandal broke. Oh, he's getting material from the outside world. I'm like, no, man. I was just, you know, I was just trying to keep tabs on my girl. And that was another one of those times where I thought that my career was over because, you know, there was me losing focus to keep tabs on a relationship when I should have been focused on my career. And next thing you know, I'm in a parking lot bawling because I thought life was over.
But then, so how does it make you feel now that you're bigger than anybody that was ever on that show?
Well, I think that was that's kind of like the same thing with American Idol. It's always the people that you know, with the exception of like Kelly Clarkson, the second place, third place, or the people that got disqualified were the ones that went on to have better careers. I was very lucky because I think the winner that season got a special on Bravo.
On Bravo.
Which, yeah, that's where you got the comedy special on Bravo.
Okay. I'm not going to say anything. I don't disparage.
I'm not going to say anything either because, you know, we can get canceled just for saying that, having this conversation.
That's right. So that brings up another question to me. Is Paul Rodriguez was a big influence for you, correct?
Yes.
And again, yes, and I don't want to be awkward here, but how does it feel to be able to fill an arena when big guys like that you looked up to won't or can't? It's a crazy feeling, isn't it?
It's an insane feeling. It really is. It's surreal. When I did my my first show at Staples, I invited Paul to come out. I says, "Hey, listen, it would mean a lot to me. You were very inspirational. You're one of the reasons why I got into this game." I says, "I would love it very much if you were to do a set on the show at Staples Center. It would be an honor to have you there." And I got a chance to sit with him in the dressing room before the show, and he was telling me, he says, "You know, there's been a lot of guys that have come and gone, and many people before you, but no, none of us have ever gotten to this level, so you've done something really special." And to hear him tell me that was like, wow, you know, it was very, like, man. And it's like seeing that out of Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. So now I have this extra added pressure out there. And fortunately, I had a really, really good set with, you know, it was hometown, L.A., Staples Center. It was just, you know, it was an amazing night. But to have Paul Rodriguez tell me that, you know, one of my idols tell me those same words was just like, wow, it was incredible.
Well, it's got to be a great, great, great feeling. Is there anybody that you, anybody from your past? You said you had a couple friends. Is there anybody in your past that you, not that you do this, but you go back and go see, you know, just the accomplishments, anybody like shove it in their face?
I know it sounds petty. I guess depending on the time of the day, I'd like to think that I'm, you know, I take the higher road.
Of course.
You know what, man? I got my moments.
Yeah, we're all human. We're all human. Is there anybody?
there's very, very few.
Don't name names. Just give us
hints.
I'm
mostly related to them, Jeff.
Wow, that's pretty great. So, okay, what about
real quick? Yeah. Back to the Paul thing for a second.
Yeah.
Being able to get to this level, I think, has a lot to do with, you know, not only ability, but we mentioned it earlier. Having you got to have some business sense, and you know, all these tools that are available now that weren't available back then. Social media has made it possible for comics to be rock stars, whereas before I think we were just looked at like, oh, the bottom of the totem pole when it came to entertainment. Whereas like now it's like, really? These guys are, you know, shoot. I was watching you fill up these arenas in countries I couldn't even pronounce. I mean, these random places, and I'm like, holy smoke, how insane is this? And then to be doing this whole, like, you're going somewhere, I'm going somewhere, and we're crossing paths, and we're close, we came close. We were two countries away from each other. To be able to do that now is insane. But again, it's a double-edged sword because comics back in the day were able to be as creative and express themselves however they wanted without being judged. You know, they could do whatever they needed to do to make their sets. Like, I don't think Sam Kinison could be Sam Kinison today.
Right.
And Sam is viewed as one of the greats. But there's no way he could get away with half of what he would talk about back then. And I'm just waiting for them to cancel him, and he's been dead forever.
Yeah, exactly. So I know you do have some plans. Can we talk about that at all?
About let's see. What's coming up? I'm going to be in the new Space Jam movie. That's one of the movies that I did here.
Is that right?
I'm pretty excited about that.
Oh, that's great.
So there's going to be a press thing happening in the next couple of weeks.
Well, congratulations. What about live shows, though? Can we talk about anything?
Live shows, we're talking about, safety is the number one priority right now.
Right.
And being able to be consistent with the safety, because, you know, you go places, sometimes they wear the mask, sometimes they don't wear the mask, sometimes there's plexiglass, sometimes they're still right in your face. You can eat inside, you can eat outside, you know. Right. What's the actual deal? And so I think that the best way for me to get back into it, because it's been over a year now, is to set up and establish some type of residency somewhere where I can have control over the backstage area and the way that the seating is, to make sure that people feel safe and comfortable and that I feel safe and comfortable. And I think that, you know, you have to be somewhere where you can have control over that. Because if you're bouncing around every night, then every day you got to restart the safety versus having everything set up front.
Because I do know that reading that you did make a Netflix deal for, I think it was two specials, if I remember reading that correctly. And you've done the one. You did one in 2019. I know you got another one. So hopefully that will happen sooner than later. I have no idea when we're going to get back to these to these big places, to these giant arenas again. And it's scary, because even going to a movie theater, how's that gonna happen? And I walked off on stage almost exactly a year ago, right now, and I said to my friends around me, you know, the people that work for me, the stage guys, I said, I've heard the reports. From what I understand, there's not going to be a 2-week turnaround in this thing. I don't think we're going to get back to this mess until Christmas of 21. And everybody looked at me like I was freaking nuts. And I said, I don't know, because when I walked off stage that last night, I was down in Florida. I thought, this is a bad feeling. This is a really sad feeling to me that I don't know when we're going to be back. And so I fear that even with the vaccines coming and, you know, what is it? 20% of the adult population in the U.S. has been inoculated. You wonder, when are people going to feel comfortable to sit next to each other and guffaw, you know, and basically laugh on each other and transfer the spit?
Nice.
You know?
Yeah, and you're right. And actually, I think you were closer than I was as far as time, because I knew that it wasn't going to be a 2-week turnaround. I thought for sure it was going to be no less than 4 months.
Right.
But, you know, again, some places are taking chances. Florida just does not care. And Texas is, I don't even know what's going to happen now.
Right.
You know, some people are about it, some people are not about it. You know, they say you can go 100% capacity, but it's all up to the people and how comfortable they are.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't want to do a show for a bunch of plexiglass.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't want to, it's not a comedy aquarium. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to go back to performing until I feel comfortable up there. And I'd rather just wait. That's why when people say, how come you don't do a live show online? I'm like, it's not the same.
Right. Sure.
I go, I don't have the fan interaction and the laughter and the energy. And they're like, oh, you just need to get with the times. I'm like, you know what? You just need to get out.
I know. People ask me that too. They go, why don't you just do a show, like you said, online? Just do a thing. And I'm like, what? They didn't know this. It's a synergy. It's a back and forth between you and the crowd that people who haven't been on stage don't understand that. And isn't it that weird to you that you know your act backwards and forwards, but if that audience isn't quite what you want, the show doesn't go as well. And you can't figure out if it's their fault or if it's your fault.
Yeah, if the timing isn't there, you know, it's a double doubt. So you're wondering how you're delivering the material, and then you're looking at the crowd like, maybe they're just like, you know, maybe I got a people that don't know me, or maybe they're, you know, because sometimes at a casino they'll comp tickets. Oh, maybe these are people that just lost their ass in the casino, hating life, and they're making me suffer.
That's the worst. You know, the worst audience is the audience that gets in free. And at the casinos, you know, they give all the high rollers the front seats, and they may or may not know who you are. Because isn't it a lot easier now than it used to be when you weren't a name?
Yeah.
Like I said, I can't even, you know, that's why corporate gigs, I just, they're easier now because I think you and I both hit a point where the name recognition is there. And so you're pre-sold even to like a corporate crowd. But corporate dates, man, I hated those things because it was like, you know, all the business guys are sitting there drinking and they've been playing golf in the sun all day and they get a giant meal and now it's late. They've done the awards and now it's like, and now guys, your entertainment tonight is a puppet show. You know what I mean? So you've had all those gigs as well, right?
Oh, God, yes, yeah. Yes. You know, I call the corporate shows for me have always been my whole gigs. Like, I know I'm holding myself out. I know I'm not going to enjoy it. But I know that, you know, I'll probably be able to buy an Escalade with this gig. So I do it. And I just kind of like, all right, brace yourself. Here we go.
Well, speaking of an Escalade, to wind this thing up, this has been really great. But what I want to ask you now is where do you want it to go? Is there a bucket list? Is there a list that you've made in the past? And there's really that golden chalice. Is there anything you're looking for, or are you very happy with the way it is now? What's next? I have a feeling you're still driving. So,
you know what? I think that I'd like to at least be able to say that I played a stadium, an actual like a football stadium, one time.
Wow!
I don't need a whole Taylor Swift tour, and it doesn't have to just be me. But I'd like to be able to say that I performed in a football stadium. For sure. And there's a few countries that I'd still like to perform in and visit that I didn't get to check off my list of places. I can say I've done film, television, stand-up specials. I definitely want to make sure that my main bucket list is keeping myself around. So I'd like to lose a few more pounds and be around to enjoy the fruits of my labor.
Well, you seem to be doing a great job with that. You know what? And it's also attitude. And I think, you know, you're one of the rare comics that seems happy, but I know that there are those down times as well. And maybe to conclude this, I do want to ask this, though. Have there been those dark, dark times that weren't just career screw-ups where you thought, you know, any of those that you'd like to share anything? Because I do think people love to hear that stuff.
Being entertainers, man, we're out on the road. Sometimes it's a little time. Sometimes it's you know, a whole run of just being away from home. And so I did have some relationships that didn't work out the way that I wanted them to, whether it was personal or family or friends and stuff like that, because my focus was very much on making sure that I did the best I could with this career. This is not something that comes along for just anybody. I mean, if you get an opportunity and you catch lightning in a bottle, man, you want to do everything in your power to protect it, to grow it, to build it. And just, I made a lot of sacrifices. At the time, I felt like, man, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I made a mistake because somebody didn't share my passion, didn't share my vision, didn't understand what I was trying to do. I think they get it now, but I think that too much time has passed. And so, yes, there has been a lot of dark moments where, oh man, this just didn't work out. You know, you grow with some people, and some people come into your life, and some people stay, and some don't. And then new people come in, and you know, and sometimes they stay, and sometimes they don't. Those are those times that are hard for me because I always try to take care of people. I always try to take care of those around me, people that make me feel good. I want to go above and beyond for them. But sometimes some people will bring you down, and you still try to see like, what can I do to make life better for you? And sometimes it just doesn't work out. And that's the hard part. And that's when you start feeling like, oh, man. And like me, I'll dwell on it. I'll take it on. And I'll really feel like, oh, man, what am I doing wrong? I'm just trying to help. And sometimes there's nothing you can do. But the stage has never, with exception to a couple of dog-kicking moments, let me down.
That's super cool. Well, buddy, maybe sometime we can do a show together. I think that would be fun. I don't know what kind of audience it is. I this is a silly question, but what percentage of the audience do you think is strictly Latino, and how much do you cross over? Do you know? Have you? I can't. Go ahead.
Nice. I'm out there counting. One little, two little. No. In the beginning, definitely. I mean, it's the root. It's the you know, that's my core audience. But I've made it a point to do shows everywhere, and the mixture of the audience. It's, you know, you go some places where, you know, I'm pretty much the only brown face in the room. So I guess it depends on where I go. If I'm performing in the Southwest, then yeah, traditionally, I mean, you're going to see a little bit more, a little bit more spice.
Well, that's what I would have guessed is that you have a major crossover. I think so many people from, it doesn't matter. And color and race doesn't matter to me, especially in comedy. And I think it's great when somebody like you or like me comes along or whoever, name it. And it's everybody. And you can close your eyes and still laugh. And it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's all about entertaining the people, but I don't forget who I am. Every day I know exactly who I am. And so it's not one of those like, oh, he's forgotten. Like, no, come on. Like, really? It's just, you know, you grow, you change, you evolve. As long as you don't forget who you are and where you came from, I think you're going to be okay. And again, the goal of the show is to be inclusive, not exclusive.
Well, I just, you know, the way we kind of started all this, I just wish people would loosen up a little bit and just learn to laugh at ourselves. It's just so much fun to be able to joke about anything and everything. And now it's just this narrow, tiny little focus about what we can joke about versus somebody getting their butt hurt.
I agree. Well. I agree. And so, I appreciate the fact that you reached out and invited me to come on the show. And this is cool. I think this is the longest conversation we've had. We've bumped into each other many times over the years. And
yeah, you were nice. You showed up at some show. I don't remember where it was. Laughlin. Was it
Vegas.
Laughlin? Vegas?
It was Vegas.
I could have sworn you. No, wait a minute. You showed up in Laughlin when it was 115 degrees. I was doing a show outside. I think you'd do the same venue.
Yes, I was going to be there a few months later, but I was there hanging out with some friends, and we came to your show. And thank you for the tickets, by the way.
Sure. I think they charged you later. Yeah, so I appreciate you coming out to the show. And, maybe, again, people want us to do a show together. I don't know what that would be like, and I don't know who would go first. You know?
If I'll put this out. If you ever want to do something like, hey, let's just start small. Let's do an ice house. Let's do an ice house in Pasadena if it's still around when comedy goes back to normal.
I'd love to do a show
with you, man. It's been one of those things people have been asking me for years. When are you guys going to do a show together? I'm like, I don't know, man. Hey,
you know what would be funny is to have you and Walter on stage together, the three of us just chatting.
I'm down for it, Jeff. If you want to do a show together, I'd love to do a show with you at any capacity. We can hang out, have drinks. I'll wake up in the morning with a hangover with a jalapeno on a stick next to me. And
well, maybe that's the arena show. And then every comedian on the planet will hate us. You know what I mean?
So that's the question to ask right now that the viewers are watching, listening. Do you guys want to see Jeff and I do a show together? And if so, where would we do it?
Gabe, I think you just broke the internet. All right, my friend, you are just a delight, and this is so much more than I expected. I expected you to be a nice guy, but to open up like this and chat with us has just been fun. So congratulations on your continued success, and I look forward to seeing what more you do and what more you come out with, because you make us all laugh, and it's, again, congratulations, and just keep going, buddy.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, man. All right, so there we had it with Gabe Iglesias. Gabriel, thank you very much for joining us on that. That was a lot of fun, right, Ahmed?
Yes, it was very interesting. I have not listened to it yet, but I'm sure it is fun. Yeah, yes. So it's good to see you two fellows, Mr. Rothstein and Mr. McNeil.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello. Nice to see you, Ahmed.
I don't care.
All right, so Ahmed, this is the segment where you get to introduce your own clip.
Yes. I was in Abu Dhabi doing the shows, and the folks there love me, as you spoke about with Gabriel Iglesias. Yeah. Are you serious? He's big there?
They love Gabe over there.
Okay. So, Mr. Rothstein, you were actually over in Abu Dhabi on the world tour with us, correct?
Yes. It was an unbelievable tour. Absolutely. Loved
yes, it was unbelievable that you were there having a good time.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't bring up the Hanukkah stuff.
No. Later, we went to Tel Aviv, and you had a much better time.
Yeah. We made it there. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. We picked out this clip, and it should be fun.
Yes. Here we are on the world tour from our show All Over the Net, which was on Comedy Central. Yes. And I am starring.
Greetings, Adu Daddy, folks. Silence! I kill you! What the hell? What? I threatened to kill them. They all go, yay!
I think some of them actually like you here.
Really? You know, since being here, I've been starting to rethink the whole suicide bomber thing.
How's that?
I blew myself up to get a new place and a few virgins. Meanwhile, 8 guys in the front row here have 5 mansions each, a bunch of hot wives, and their own skin. I had no idea these options were available.
Hey, everybody, one little bonus thing we're going to add here at the end. Audrey has joined me, and we're on one earpiece here, so this is why there's an ear thing sticking out of my head, for those of you who can see it.
You're wired for sound.
I am. And Audrey, by description, Matt had this painting commissioned. He actually had an artist paint this.
Okay.
Because of our past joking with him and me and Jim Ricker.
And so really, it's a Christmas present for the two of you.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, and we got to find a nice place in the house where to hang this thing.
Why am I so scared right now?
Okay. Be very afraid.
All right, so here it is. This is it right here. Hold on. There it is.
Oh, nice.
Do you recognize this, Audrey?
Of course.
It's Potato Jesus.
Potato Jesus or Monkey Christ. This is so. As I've explained to Matt, Audrey, oh, that I think he is actually going to go to hell for this.
Oh, no.
There is a silver lining, a very upside to that whole story.
Yeah, I'll tell you about it later. But a bunch of people started going to that church, so she has forwarded the gospel with her awful painting.
Nice, and it provides lots of laughs.
Yeah, lots of laughs. That's right. And as it will continue to provide lots of laughs in our house, right in the entryway when people come to see us.
Wow.
I expect to see that hanging when I come to your house.
I know.
Oh my God. Nice.
My feelings are going to be hurt.
Yeah, every time Matt comes over, honey, we have to remember and pull this out of the closet and hang it up.
Right. Okay. Deal.
I'll let you know when I go over.
No, I think, you know what? You know what? I think the quest should be, and people should write in at fanmail@jeffdunham.com. Who should I re-gift this to?
Oh, no. It's a white elephant gift.
Honestly,
you can re-gift it back to me. I will put that up in my house.
No, this is great. We're going to put it up. It's going to start conversations or end them.
And if you're just listening to the podcast, visit Jeff's YouTube channel because you can see what this picture looks like.
Exactly. All right, everybody. Audrey, thanks for joining us. Jeff Rothman, Matt McNeil, this has been fun. Gabriel Iglesias, thank you, my friend. And we will see you guys and hear you guys next time on the Jeff Dunham Podcast.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.